Hi, this is Esty, host of the Friday A Public Affair. I hope you help us by contributing to WORT, and you can also subscribe to the podcast. Bye.
6'6" above sea level. I grab my mic because I like to take you to another mental level. Low power frequency radio modulation. The big sound from underground. We bring the truth to places.
No change without struggle. No one in power ain't giving up nothing. No change without struggle. No one in power.
WORT 89.9 FM, listener-sponsored community radio, Madison, Wisconsin. And hello, welcome to A Public Affair. I am STD Noor. Thanks, first of all, to the folks who subbed for me, Richelle, Jean, and Karma, and allowed me to have some quality time with my family. Appreciate you subbing. So this is my first show of 2022, and I wanted to do something different to start this year, which I think is going to be a very important year in so many ways. We talk here almost always about the issues that are troubling our world and about what we can do. And I believe that we cover very important issues that many of the other media do not discuss, including outlets like NPR. So I'm very glad and very grateful to have the opportunity to do that, but we usually remain on the level of being informed and being active in organizations, political processes, through solidarity and good deeds, and so on and so forth. It is my personal experience that working in the external world is enormously important, but not sufficient. That real change comes from within, and if we don't work on that sort of change, if we go around in the world being a bundle of childhood trauma and ancestral trauma that we possibly are not even aware of, we are less likely to be able to make a real sustained change in the world. So with the hope that we can work on that too, I invited a man who lives very much in the world and is very, perhaps achingly, aware of the many troubles we are facing, and whose work is in the realm of the internal and of the ancestral. I am delighted to have Daniel Fohr, PhD. He is a licensed psychotherapist, doctor of psychology, and the author of Ancestral Medicine, Rituals for Personal and Family Healing. Since 2005, he has led ancestral healing intensives in 8 countries, trained over 60 practitioners, and supported thousands with ancestral reconnection through online teachings and sessions, me included. Daniel is an initiate in the Orisha tradition of Yoruba-speaking West Africa and has learned from teachers of Mahayana Buddhism, Islamic Sufism, and the older ways of his English and German ancestors. He lives with his wife and daughters in Western North Carolina, homeland of the Cherokee people. And you can find more about him and his work at ancestralmedicine.org. Hi, Daniel. Thank you for joining us today.
Thank you so much, Esty, for the invitation.
I appreciate having you. Let's start with just a quick explanation of the term ancestral reconnection. What is it? How would it help us make the world better, mend the world, as I think of it?
Yeah, those are big, good, important questions. I can situate myself first a little, as you did in the introduction, by saying that I'm down lineage from settler colonialists, English, German folks, especially to North America, and I live in occupied traditional Cherokee lands here in Western North Carolina. I wasn't raised with a framework for any of these kinds of things that we're speaking of, but through involvement in ritual and ceremony and pagan things and things like that, I I realized that it's possible to connect not only with the plants and the animals and the elements and the rest of life, but also my own ancestors, which I hadn't been encouraged to give focus to. And in that process, I came to understand that my own ancestry is not defined only by the recent centuries of harm and cultural amnesia that enabled a lot of the problematic genocidal history in North America toward indigenous folks, African folks, but that my ancestry additionally includes older ones and ones who lived before remembered names, and it's possible to come into relationship with them. And so that's been a part of my life for maybe 25 years. And so when I use the word ancestors, I'm referring to the collective wisdom of our species as humans and to the ones who are not incarnate right now, but to who we're still in connection or relationship with. So the ancestors in that way are in the present. They're not only the ones who we have names and memories of. And in that way, human is like a big collective spirit or energy, some of whom is incarnate, like you and I, and some of whom are not right now. And in that way, the ancestors are also the ones who are waiting to be born again. So all the ones who are not here right now. And they have a tremendous influence on the living. And we can not choose to relate with that consciously. That's okay. That influence might be really good and really supportive and just not conscious. But if we do bring the presence and influence of the ancestors more conscious through any kinds of traditions of ancestor reverence or ritual or reconnection, then it's an opportunity to more effectively transform what remains to be healed and to come into direct relationship in a way that's resourcing, enjoyable, inspired with those among our people who are really loving and wise and able to help us out and help us to have a really meaningful life. So the ancestors are good allies in that way for cleaning up family trauma, intergenerational trauma, certainly helpful to carve out some sense of authentic belonging when there are really difficult histories of displacement or occupation of others' lands or intergenerational debts that we've inherited or trauma that we've inherited. The ancestors, they were there when it went down. You know, they're involved in it, they're implicated, and they're also able to bring healing and reconnection.
Mm-hmm. So talking about ancestral trauma, I want to share with you a notion that I heard not from you and that is very intriguing to me. And that's the thought that we've been fighting the same wars right from the dawn of humanity, that nothing is ever resolved in war. And so people, usually those who were vanquished, feel the need to try again. And so it goes on forever and ever and has gone through many generations, which would be if you agree with that, I think that would be an argument for why this work is so important. So that maybe we can stop having these wars. Maybe we will be able to find ways to revert the amazing resources that we have into life-sustaining and life-supporting endeavors instead of war.
Yeah, I think I probably agree for the most part that our particular moment in history, although it feels very special, is on some level, we're not that special. We're not more special than folks who lived 85,000 years ago. And, we're at a moment where it's really decisive because humans have so radically altered the rest of the biosphere. So that's new to the degree that we've done it. But, what I would say is all the elements of culture also live within us, and that it's important for us to affirm, like from a magical ritual perspective, it's important for us to affirm our core values, not only to oppose problematic things. Yes, we want to be able to recognize different kinds of supremacy and how toxic that is, interpersonally, systemically, whatever, whether that's around race, around gender, around the playing out of colonialism or class or religion, you know, the attitude that you or your group is better than someone else and someone else's group. That's not a new pattern. I think that is an innate human risk if we don't have a lot of correction as we're growing up, that humans can turn out badly because we're pattern recognizing creatures, and we sometimes will privilege our own pattern if we don't have a proactive value that affirms the beauty and importance of diverse forms. And so in that way, what I do hold like a core values approach more than a religious or spiritual approach. And so we could frame, it's critically important and great to speak about anti-racist ethics. And it's also possible to frame it as a proactive celebration of ancestral diversity accompanied by proactive repairs where that hasn't been the case historically. And so framing things in the affirmative of what you do want to call in is one way to create culture. We can't only tear down things. There needs to be an affirmation of what kind of world we want to live in. And one of the kinds of supremacy that I find a lot of folks involved in really critically important activist type work don't always get at is the human supremacy over the other than humans. And I know this, it can get framed as like a religious or a metaphysical stance, but I don't mean to hold it in that way any more than it's a metaphysical stance to say white people aren't better than other people. Is that metaphysical or is that just good values? So if we say that's just good values, then we can also say it's good values to recognize there are tree people, stone people, deities, elemental powers, spirits in the earth, ancestors, etc. But once you start talking like that, a whole demographic of people tunes you out. But I'm saying if we don't make that leap to recognize that what cuts us off from those others is the same kind of supremacist thinking, our systems will continue to center humans, will continue to generate ecological catastrophe, and it's going to be hard to stabilize good cultural change.
So that takes us to the latest series that you offered to the general public, to people who are now taking some of your specialized courses. You titled it The Opening Earth. And I wonder why you chose that title. What do you mean by it? And if you can tell us what it was all about. I know, but our listeners probably don't.
The inspiration from that was actually Surat al-Zilzala in Islam from the Quran, the Surah 99 in the Quran. But the imagery is provided, you know, it's given in other surahs and in the Quran, of the death of the body, but also the kind of reckoning or judgment where the earth opens and the bodies that are in the earth or the souls in the soul in the body or the ancestors face accountability for our choices, and that there's a reckoning. And that is, you know, there are mystical layers or ways to understand that. I don't mean to get so, you know, apocalyptic about all of it. But what's compelling to me about the linking of like accountability and reckoning as an ethic with the earth and with the ancestors is that we're at this moment right now in history where it's not like, oh, real bad stuff's going to go down if you keep doing that ecologically. It feels to me like we've crossed the kind of threshold. It's like the pandemic is you know, the welcome party of this new phase. And like, welcome to, you know, you're in it. You're in the sandstorm. It's not the weather report. You're in the sandstorm now. Settle in. This is what you have invoked upon yourself. So how do we navigate as like loving, kind people within that? If we're raising two daughters here, what do I tell them about the world? And part of the intent of that title and the spirit of that is there's an invitation in there to just turn right toward the mess and be like, okay, there's not two worlds. There's not some other life that's going to happen after death necessarily. It's not exactly like that, that there's just this complex, beautiful, holy mess that we've made here. And how do we lean in to the intensity of things and see that there actually is a future with this planet, with the humans, that's really beautiful and really possible, and hone in on that and try to get drawn by that so that we can organize our lives around it, that we can move in a way that's ethical, that's loving and kind, and still have our eyes open about the catastrophe that we're in. Because mm-hmm. it's very sad also what we've done. It's really sad. And if there's not an ability to slow down and feel that a bit, then we're going to become annoying people who run from our grief and can't really lead with heart in the world. Because nobody really needs more doom, like, you know, all that. People also at this point, like, because we're in it, there's a need for a lot of kindness and empathy as well.
Yeah, this is such a good point. I remember myself doing some serious internal work, and that's also a long time ago, but I was all doom and gloom. And I don't think that was very effective. Indeed, people run away from me. So, good point. My guest is Daniel Foer. He's a licensed psychotherapist, doctor of psychology, and the author of Ancestral Medicine, Rituals for Personal and Family Healing. You can join the conversation by calling here, 608-256-2001, extension 9. You can also join us on social media at War Talk on Twitter or A Public Affair on Facebook, and Richelle will send me your comments or questions. So talking about the a human supremacy over other life forms, and about what we have caused the biosphere, you said, and I've heard that from others, I've heard it from indigenous peoples, really, from various parts of the world, that when we harm the earth, we harm ourselves, which I think is so obvious, right? I mean, we can't live in an environment that cannot sustain us. But why don't you expand on that notion?
Yeah, I want to give a shout of like respect and appreciation to feminist queer theory and just a lot of the, you know, millions of folks living in ways, being who they are, that trouble the binaries and that complicate and undermine, often intentionally, the rigid binaries around gender. And that sensibility applies here around the unhelpful binary between humans and nature. The idea that somehow there's a nature, like the idea of nature is a really toxic idea, insofar as it implies that humans are other than nature. It reinforces human supremacy. It throws us out of dialogue and therefore out of accountability with our other than human kin. And it often fetishizes indigenous people by asking them to hold this view that, oh, that's nice, you talk to the trees and all that. Well, there's a whole bunch of the 95% of the world that isn't legally and politically indigenous needs to start talking yesterday to the trees, because the rivers, the mountains, the others whose communities, the other than human folks whose communities we are enacting harm toward in our life choices, we have an ethical and moral accountability to them as well. And that they're often not considered in our legal and political systems. And until that happens, those systems aren't going to really function that well on the earth. And so there's a need to interrupt the idea that we're separate from the rest of life, or so-called nature, either there's no nature or it's all nature. Either way messes up the binary in good ways and leads to a conclusion that, oh, well, we have a problem now because all of our legal, educational, even the grammar of the language, the political structures perpetuate this idea that humans are above all the others. So then we need to figure out other systems that don't create that same kind of confusion. So that's, you know, there are other more like psychological levels to it where our sense of belonging is really messed with when we don't recognize that we have kinship, not just with our pets, but with the land where we're at, the plants in our home, the wood, the, you know, the metals and the fire and the, you know, petroleum that allows for this conversation to be happening, that we're part of, we are the earth also. And so in that way, absolutely, the ways that we harm our other than human communities also reverberate through us, and we're made of them. We're made of the elements. Most of our physical body is genetically other than us in terms of microorganisms. So we're made of many things. You know, there's no separation ultimately.
Mm-hmm. So you are not an indigenous person. You are a white man, which to a large degree is seen nowadays as the problem with the world, and to a large degree for good reasons. And not, you know, not to fetishize indigenous peoples. Of course, they have warred each other, and, you know, they haven't lived necessarily a perfect, harmonious life. But wherever we look in the world, it is indigenous peoples who are seeing themselves as protectors of their environment. It's also they're the people who know their environment well enough to live in it in harmonious ways to the degree it's still possible, considering what we have done to the environment. So I wonder, I have two questions. One is, how do you understand the fact that people of the North, that white people, have been so invested in going elsewhere, what they call exploring, conquering, taking natural resources, subjecting the people who have always lived there? And so that's question one. And related question is, why is it that white people, and, you know, maybe white men even more than white women, are having such a hard time reckoning with that and coming into the place where change might happen?
Yeah. Well, the European ancestor folks, white people, of course, don't have a monopoly on terrible behavior. Like, there are, like, empire and atrocity and genocide that at times plays out without any white people involved. So it would be more white centering to say that only white people enact doom, but nonetheless, European colonialism in the last 500 plus years has been a disaster for almost everybody outside of Europe and for the majority of Europe who's working class and doesn't always benefit from that terrible behavior themselves. And so, yes, to the depth of trouble. And we could do a kind of cultural autopsy about what ethics within Europe led to that kind of horrible behavior being enacted on others, like what breakdown of earth-honoring local ethics leads to a situation where folks in power can legitimize occupying others' lands, denigrating their culture, etc. It feels like a bigger discussion about the different drivers of that, but they're in some ways predictable. Like, it's the risk that we as humans will think that our particular form is better than other forms. It needs corrected early in life with an affirmative ethic that celebrates diversity and that is relentlessly reinforced, or else we'll go will go wrong with it. I think humans need a lot of correction along the way. And those systems of correction broke down to a large degree. And so the question of why are white men having a hard time of it, it's hard to generalize. I know a lot of really like amazing, hard connected white dudes, but as a guy, at least growing up in the United States, I didn't get much encouragement to pursue my own maturation as an adult emotionally. I think men are conditioned to be a bit emotionally disconnected in a way that means that when it's time to really deal with the depth of like the rawness of being an emotional adult, they're under-equipped, you know, at least in the white American culture I grew up in. And I think the U.S. part of that is really important insofar as the level of extreme individualism that I observe to be part of the culture in the United States and then often gets exported from here in problematic ways. I think it's really, it's like the far end of, like the far other direction of where we need to head in terms of an ethic of relationality, of recognizing how embedded we are in all these other kinds of relationships and how part of being a grown-up and really what we ought to be valuing is the ability to move with love and respect and service within those other kinds of relationships. But there's rewards financially and status wise for not doing that. And so in that way, we still end up culturally celebrating folks who are being really hazardous, unfortunately. But what shifts it? It's hard to know. Like sometimes people choose a more connective relational way, or it's just their soul disposition, or they have good instincts or good education, good people around them. And sometimes they're on a trajectory and the spirits or the powers or fate or whatever you want to call it comes in and knocks them off their trajectory. They get sick, they have an accident, they have a big loss, they have a big opening, they eat some really strong psychoactive thing, or you know, whatever happens, their world is rocked a bit. In those moments, those are moments of real big opportunity. And I would love to see it normalized that we have this kind of cultural net that's ready to catch as many people as possible who are ready to drop out of that harmful dominant paradigm and into a more accountable frame. Also, white men as like apex cultural predators, to say it in a rough way, can sense, I think, if I slow down and tune in, I probably got a backlog of harm, and I'm not sure if I want to actually look at that. So there's an emotional disincentive to reckoning. But, you know, it gets easier. It's way better to do it now than to have to face that when you die. That's the death before death. To come back to your other question, the opening earth is to choose to face your own death and to take account now before the death of the body so that you can actually live in a new way.
Yeah, and again, from personal experience, yes, it gets easier and it gets more interesting because it's a work that's never done, right? You peel a layer and you think you're good, and well, there's 50 more, and you peel 51, and there's 1,000 more, and so on and so forth. But yeah, it gets easier as you get used to it. But also I think that even before you die, it's often the case that if you don't face things, they come and haunt you, and it gets so much harder in this lifetime. But I would like to get our caller who's been waiting on the line here for a little bit. Phil, you're on the air.
Thank you. And thanks to your guest for dispelling the generalization that white males are unfit in this way. I am well into my 70s, and when I was in Africa, I felt some of the same prejudice towards me, particularly in Tanzania, where the Nyeri adherents were very, very up had was, I wanted to ask you about the spectrum of American population in general, between willing to make the ultimate sacrifice even, all the way over to the other side of the spectrum, which is complete, utter, despicable, in my opinion, self-indulgence. Where do you see the United States generally today on that spectrum versus 20, 40, and 70 years ago?
Yeah, it's a good question. I mean, I, like so many, thank you, Phil, for what you shared overall. I, like a lot of people, feel real distress at where things have been headed, even in the last, you know, 6-7 years. And so I'm acutely concerned about things holding together here. And I struggle personally, to be honest, with how, with my feeling about being in the body of and in the psyche of the United States. It's a really, it's a heavy lifting right now, insofar as there's just such a longing for almost a majority, or maybe a majority of folks, to really face in a new way how the nation was forged through genocide toward indigenous and African folks, and in a together way to figure out how to move forward from that and make honest repairs and have honest discussions. And of course, a lot of folks have been doing that and living that, but I mean, as a national kind of in national spirit of that. I think, for example, of some of the really commendable work that Germany undertook after World War II, more than places even like Italy or Japan. And so there's a need for that kind of reckoning that has happened to a degree in other places that hasn't happened enough here yet. So that's tough. It's tough to see things not moving even more in that direction. Nationally, although there are a lot of hopeful trends, and there's nothing to do but work toward it. In terms of the self-indulgence versus self-sacrifice, I think that in the United States, because of the narratives that were, I don't know if they were needed, but they were the narratives that led to the differentiation of the U.S. from England and being a, you know, very pioneering, individualistic kind of nation, in all the long shadow that casts as well, we have this tendency toward being really individualistic. And sometimes even that sense of service, like serving the nation, can be a way of displacing our own narcissism, of saying, instead of saying, I'm the best, you say, well, I'm a humble servant of the best nation. And so once it's the same pattern, it just became hidden under nationalism. And so I am not a fan of nationalism as an overall ethic. And that said, some of the people, you know, including my own ancestors who fought in the Civil War or different world wars, perhaps less so in my personal case, some of that service is really, really essential and really helped to stop Nazi Germany, for example. So I don't mean to diminish anyone's service. It's just to say that selfless service for the nation has its own kind of risk if it's not from a really discerning place. Right? And so, yeah, I find an ethic of facing our history with honesty and of being in service also with the land here, to be underrepresented. I wish there were more of that. And I know that the United States tends to hold this view of U.S. exceptionalism, which is frankly really off-putting to the rest of the world, who are also just as exceptional. But yeah, so that's what I got on that. But look, everybody, like, we're all people. We're all just trying to work it out and being part of a collective with a few hundred million others. That's a complex bunch of humans trying to work it out on a national level. You know?
Yeah, thank you, Phil. I want to ask you, Daniel, about the drama triangle. I'm not sure that's the right, but the notion that we are all victimizer or helper, and that we are that at different points in our time, in our life. These are roles that we play subconsciously. And I want to talk about, you know, if you can clarify that, but also I want to talk about that in the context of being an activist and playing that these roles, and also in the context of our relationship to the earth.
Yeah. I mean, in a real general way, I think that a lot of folks doing spiritual practice and inner work and personal healing could stand to get a bit more involved in activism per se. And a lot of folks doing activism who haven't already done it, I don't mean to generalize, could stand to add a little bit of inner work, reflection, cultivation as well, that there's another kind of problematic binary between the two. We need to address only the outer world or only the inner world. So we need, of course, we need both. Otherwise, we can bring a really toxic attitude to our activism or replicate patterns that are reflective of the systems we're trying to heal. Or we can just avoid all that and our own spirituality becomes a narcissistic, like self-reinforcing bubble. So we need to avoid those different extremes, right? And one way, the one risk with seeking to change institutions and systems and policy in a super necessary way, like big respect to people spending a lot of time doing that. One risk is that you'll tend to situate the problem outside of yourself only and to say, I'm the rescuer, or perhaps I'm the rescuer slash victimized person. And it's not that real harm doesn't occur, but if you make an identity out of being only those positions on the triangle, then you'll fail to see how the ability to enact harm or be a victimizer, it also lives within you. And it's not that life is only defined by these three experiences, but it's important for us to know overall that the horror, the real horror, and the willful badness that would tear the world apart lives within us. It lives in our very own heart. And if we don't know that deeply, then our attempt to change the systems or to shift people's views is going to risk getting righteous. And we don't necessarily need more righteousness in the world, more passion and commitment. Yeah, totally. But heart-centered passion is different than the idea that you're better than someone. You have the right view. And the left in the United States is just as vulnerable to that kind of righteousness as any other group, and it can have its own puritanical rigidity and its own like intense cognitive dissonance between like espousing abolitionist politics, for example, on the one hand, and then relating with one's friends and colleagues in a very police-like like way, this kind of extreme ideological way that we're in, punitive way. And so we need to work from a place of cultivation and love and recognizing that we're all up in the mess together. And as some of the folks that I see carry that ethic in the most inspired way are like indigenous activists, for example, who are doing ceremony also in addition to the activism, or like people in the, like here in North Carolina, some of the communities of faith, especially people of color, who are like working from this faith-based perspective, but they're working to change systems as well. Like they're caring for relationships, they're bringing a spirit of like fierce love, and they're trying to change the systems. And so that, it's hard to face the mess in the world and keep your heart open, but I think our activism will become less effective if we can't hold that ethic of love and humility as well.
So practically speaking, I think we had 4 years in which many of us felt true burning hatred towards the president and the sure. the other, allow me to say it, monsters that he brought with him that came out of the woodwork and that are still now very strong and endanger this country, endanger the world. We don't know what will happen in the elections this year and in 2 years. So that's just one example, right? We had Scott Walker before him, who was kind of the pre-Trump. What do you do when you have to, when you have these situations to deal with and you try to do it the right way? You try to do it in a way that will mend the world rather than add more strife and more hatred and more pain and, you know, going back to wars, more wars, right? Whether they be with weapons or with words and so on. What do you think? How do we get there?
The first thing is there's not one right way to do it. And even whatever I would say is just my take on it. And so the idea True. That there's a right way to do it gets off on the, not that you're suggesting that, but it gets off on the wrong foot because it suggests there's just one correct pattern. And then we're back in that realm of ideological correctness and rightness, et cetera. But so what I would say is everybody's got their own soul level destiny and needs and calling. And some people do an activism per se, might have a calling to be like a really, really good cook. And they open a restaurant or they're going to, you know, they have a different soul level thing that they need to be focused on for their well-being. And ideally they're focused there. And to do that is actually going to bring about in unpredictable ways, greater service in the world. And other people who are afraid about stepping into addressing policy and all of that, need to get over there because that's actually, they're trying to be really nice when they actually have a lot of warriorship and a lot of fierceness in them that needs to lean in that direction. So we need to be true to our own soul level calling and destiny. And if we don't know what that is, then we need to prioritize understanding ourselves better because that will lead to most effective service to begin with. And then I think there's, you know, I don't always live this ethic. It's hard. But when I see it, I recognize it as more mature than whatever I'm doing. I think of somebody, I think of an interview with Ruby Sales, for example, as a Southern civil rights leader and activist and elder. And she, in one of her interviews, said something to the effect of, she was speaking about really obviously difficult things that she's lived through and witnessed, and said something to the effect of, I'm not going to give other people the power to take away my own happiness. Like you can't cause me to not be loving. You can't take away my core values. Like and that spirit of saying, I'm going to be fiercely loving and hold out the vision of you, annoying person, becoming well, even if you're terrible to me. Like, you're not going to throw me off my own center. You're not going to cause me to split the world into these different camps in this really fragmented way. I'm going to fiercely hold the world together. And yeah, that might mean you need stopped. It doesn't mean we have to be nice all the time, but it means we can hold our center on core values and know that also the work, you know, the big work, the great work, it doesn't get resolved in this lifetime. This is a many lifetime long undertaking here on earth. So we need to have a little bit of a long view as well, because you know, the conditions we're descending into even further in this country, they're really familiar to folks in lots of other countries. It's like, yeah, solidarity, y'all just dropped a notch. Like, good to see you colleagues over in, you know, Egypt or Venezuela, or, you know, 100 other countries who are struggling to just have functioning institutions in the same way like us.
But I think you're also saying that there is a place for solidarity with everyone, including, let's take that example of Trump. I mean, it is my assumption that a person doesn't get to be a Trump without having some very serious trauma that he's never dealt with, and without suffering that he might not be aware of or reckon with. But yeah, he is basically just another human who's suffering. However, you know, he's also making a lot of other people suffer.
I think we really want to see things through an individual lens, but I think it's useful and more honest and even kind to see them on a systemic lens. Trump is just an obvious congealing of the 80 million plus people who have similar dispositions and leanings. It's like the manifestation of the underlying energy that's there. And it's not to make it just about him is to overlook the larger systemic trouble, because it's easy to make it about a person. And is he hazardous? Yes. Does he bring out a lot of the worst in folks? Yeah, absolutely. But I think it's important to see people in the larger ancestral and group context. So the energy that someone like Donald Trump doesn't come out of nowhere. So how do we get at those root divisions? Yeah, I it doesn't mean we have to play nice about it. I don't want him or people like that in positions of power for all kinds of obvious reasons. But when the reaction is like, but we need to like violent uprising or whatever, this kind of desperate thing, I'm like, well, that doesn't actually, it doesn't lead to good outcomes. It doesn't. That's not my understanding of where we need to head. Not that you're saying that, but when the systems aren't functioning, what do you do? Ooh, that's tough. There's no quick move on it.
Yeah. So, are you hopeful that enough people can do enough work to change things for the better before our planet cannot sustain us anymore? Or is that not necessarily the right way to look at it? Is it that we each should do or need to do the best that we can and stop at that without the need to hope or to expect and so on?
I guess more the second. We've already passed certain thresholds. It could get much, much worse. I mean, the choices are worse, a whole lot worse, or extremely, extremely worse. And so I'm rooting for worse if we can. That's the best possible outcome here. We need to stay focused on what is needed from us individually today in the moment. Like, what's my accountability to the earth, to God, to the spirits, to call it what you will? Like, what to the real elder function in my world? What do I need to be doing personally? Where's my heavy lifting? Where's my responsibility? That needs to be our primary focus most of the time. And then if we need to look up and be like, what's the meta story? What's in the news today? What's happening in the world? Yeah, of course. I do that too. I'm interested in what our larger story is. But, you know, the short-term prognosis in this country seems kind of bad, unfortunately. But who knows, in 5, 10 years, 15 years, 50 years, we have to think long-term. And in that sense, I think humans will be around for a minute. I don't think it's going to get so severe that human life can't continue, but it would be nice if we didn't have to drag down half the biological diversity on the planet before we figured out how to play nice with others. But that depends on how quick we can make the pivot. We don't make it individually. It doesn't happen through willpower only. There's so much loss happening right now. It's important to be able to grieve and to just recognize, like, wow, like, there's a lot, like, I feel sad today. Or there's a lot of, my heart is heavy with what's happening in the world. Jesus, tough. So much loss. And then to ask the earth and the ancestors, how do you want me to be in it today? What's my contribution today? Because I want to show up well and I want to do right by the elders. You know, what's my role today? A little bit more like that. Because if we get righteous and angry, we can go to war, but then we've made, you know, then we're at war again.
Yeah. Well, we have about 3 minutes left. I would like you to, well, first of all, add anything that you'd like to add that I didn't ask about, but also let people know how, if this conversation got them curious, how they can learn more about your work specifically. And also, one thing that I appreciate about your work is that you have a fee structure that allows everybody to participate, whether they can afford to or not, which is not a capitalistic way, Daniel.
All the info for what I'm up to is at ancestralmedicine.org, and we have some free talks coming up this month, introductory talks on ancestral healing with me and some of the others in the network. And we have a course on ancestral healing that begins in early February. And like you said, any of our courses have accessibility features, and we have a very international directory and network of practitioners of ancestral healing. And so, yeah, check out what we're up to with the site and the courses. And yeah, that we do have a values-driven approach to animist ethics and ancestral healing. And what I would say by way of outro is just that if we're calling into question unhealthy structures and unhealthy aspects of culture, excuse me, that need to shift, one of those is the idea that spirituality and religion is some kind of dogmatic thing, when actually a lot of those teachings that get compartmentalized into that category are just about coming back into relationship with life and knowing how to move in a heart-open way with the land, with our ancestors. Those are normal things. Those are normal things for any human being, to notice our connection to the rest of life and know how to navigate that. So all that's learnable. It's learnable and accessible in a way that's also culturally healing and humble.
Well, Daniel Fohr is a licensed psychotherapist, doctor of psychology, the author of Ancestral Medicine, Rituals for Personal and Family Healing. And as he just said, you can find a lot of information at ancestralmedicine.org. Thank you so much, Daniel, for spending this time with me on my first show of the year. I really appreciate this conversation.
Thanks so much, Esty, and to everybody listening. Appreciate it.
Thank you. And thanks to Richelle and Summer. Get better. I'm Esty Dinor. We'll be talking again next week. Dark vision, fly by helicopters in the night. Attempt triangulation of our station in the fight. Straight from the base, deep down, no precision.